In Hamilton. And some of us are familiar with Shalem, some are not. We have done one seminar in the past with Shalem about 2 years ago. And tonight we wanted to do something a little bit different than before and make it a lot more practical in terms of things that we can all use for this very important topic of emotional wellness, because it affects 100% of it. There's none of us that it does not affect. And so we're all looking for things that we can do, you know, to help ourselves, but also to help other people, help the people that we love. Shalem, the folks at Shalem, they're experts in this. They're a Christian counseling center, and they have a lot of resources to bring to this. Now, tonight, Stephen will be speaking from a Christian perspective, but it will not be explicitly a Christian presentation. There'll be things that you can use whether or not you are practicing in the faith or not. So, Stephen, we really appreciate you coming all the way from Hamilton and coming out. I think we're going to take questions. You'll handle some as we go, but also give people an opportunity to collect questions. So. If you have questions, I can write them down as you go. Does anybody want to text me their questions as you go? Because I can give you the phone number you could text them to if you wanted to make note of that. So we could do it either way. If you want to text them, write down this number. Okay, some of you are just grabbing a pen. And we have. Does anyone need a pen, too, for tonight? If you need a pen, we can do those. While you're getting your pens out to write down the phone number to text your questions, the bathrooms are right behind us, so probably easiest if you go out this way and go around to the washrooms here, okay? So if you have a question during the presentation, you can text it to 647-280-6275. If you have a question and Stephen wants to defer it to the end, I've got a clipboard. I'll write it down so you don't have to be making notes. And Stephen may handle some of the questions as we go. So we'll go for about an hour, and then we'll attack some of those questions at the end. So Stephen, without further ado, thank you very much for coming, and we'll turn the time over to you.
Great, thank you. Everybody can hear me okay? Yeah. Not bad? Okay, great. Well, it's really nice to be here. We got almost, I think, about 50 people, which is wonderful, because I had no idea what the turnout was going to be like, so it's good. How many people are regular attenders here, just out of curiosity? Okay, so we're just maybe a bit over half, but that's good. So I work for Shalem Mental Health Network. I've worked there for about a year and a half, full-time for about a year. I come from an addictions background. I won't say much about me, but so you understand a little bit. I worked in an addictions background for about 10 years after I did my master's. So I've worked in a lot of outpatient programs. So I often say it was a lot of one-to-one counseling, and addictions, substance use, all those things are what kind of brings people in the door. But once people are in the door and I'm working with them one-on-one, I'm doing counseling. It's the same as with anybody else. It's just that substance use is kind of the piece that is identified there. So about a year ago, I started working full-time with Shalem and doing counseling with them. So I work in the probation offices 3.5 days now, so providing counseling to clients that are on probation or parole. And then I work also in our clinic in Hamilton, downtown Hamilton, seeing clients there as well, just a wide variety of clients, folks like yourselves. And this is how to maintain emotional health in a stressed out world, which Mark was kind enough to kind of come up with that title. But really the focus of tonight is going to be on mental wellness and emotional health. It's not going to be on mental illness. So that's going to be the shift that some of you might not have kind of thought of that coming in. It might not have been that obvious based on that. We see the word emotional health or mental health, and sometimes that can mean a lot of different things, but I'll talk more in a sec about that. The only other thing I forgot to mention, this is not showing up at all. It's interesting how that's totally white out, but normally that's a tree. I don't know where the tree went. It's just white. It would have been better. All the leaves are gone, and the whole tree. So this is just briefly to show, that's our logo if you've ever seen it. Maybe I'll leave that till the end to talk more about us, but we do a few different programs there, and I think, I don't know if I'm going to get into that, I think I'm not going to right now. If there's interest at the end, we can go into that a little bit if you're wondering about us as an agency. So mental health versus mental illness, because I think that's what some people think of. And even at the beginning, when I first heard about this, when it came across my desk that somebody was wanted to do a presentation like this, we think of mental illness often. What are some words we think of when we hear mental illness?
Depression.
Yeah, depression is the big, probably most common. Anxiety, yeah. Yeah, so those are things that come in different degrees. It's like a spectrum. You know, there's minor anxiety, minor depression. There's actually some types of anxiety that are helpful and good. Depression can come from all sorts of different places. And then it leads all the way to, say, clinical depression and clinical anxiety, which would be more on the mental illness side. So mental illness is just something that disrupts your mental state, or it interrupts how you feel, think, communicate, or behave. So, yeah, again, we're not focusing on that. There are stats that probably people have heard. There's the Bell Let's Talk Day and all those different initiatives now. Mental health has never been talked about more. But they'll say 1 in 5 people in the general population will experience some type of mental illness in their life. So that would be, in this room, that would be at least 10 people. And it could be higher than that, but I've heard recently them saying even 1 in 4. That can be for all different reasons, often to do with the medical profession likes to diagnose those things. So that can be like even just brain. We hear brain chemistry a lot, and that can mean a lot of different things. Again, I'm not going to get into that tonight. But mental illness is something that is real, and it's something that can be really treated, and there's lots of hope. And what I'm going to be talking about is kind of on the other end of the spectrum. Sometimes you'll hear it as mental illness, and then on the other end is kind of mental health or thriving, people that are thriving, people that are doing really well. We all fall somewhere in between there, probably. Most days, not everybody's thriving or knocking on all cylinders every single day. Somewhere in between there is kind of this word that they sometimes will use as surviving or languishing. And that's just the idea of sometimes we go through periods where we might not feel terribly down, but we also don't really feel that up either. There's not a lot of positive emotion, and we're kind of just feeling like life is kind of blah. And that's actually probably where a lot more of us spend some time, because that's life. So when we're looking at this, again, not going to spend much time, but I think it's clear too, because there are some people that came tonight that might be expecting mental illness. There's definitely people in this room that have experienced mental illness either personally or through like loved ones or friends or that kind of thing. We're looking at wellness as all of the things I'm going to talk about tonight apply whether there's mental illness or not. So good well-being can exist whether you have a mental health diagnosis or whether you don't. Poor mental wellness or poor well-being can exist if you do have a mental health diagnosis, but also if you don't and you're not taking care of yourself in lots of different ways. So that's to kind of show the whole spectrum of what we're working with. Is there any questions about that? Does that make sense? Yeah. The big point driving home is, yeah, you can be mentally well and still have a mental illness. And I think sometimes people don't necessarily think about that. But being treated properly with sometimes medication, sometimes therapy, all those different things. And sometimes even someone with no diagnosis benefits from some of those things. So it's not it's a very gray, murky world. It's not necessarily black and white like we sometimes think. So I'm going to play a bit of a game here. I'm not going to get you all to get up because there's too many. But it's agree or disagree. At the end, I'm going to give handouts, which are going to cover a lot of the main points that I'm going to go through. So if you like taking notes and you learn like that, great. But if you don't, you're going to get a lot of this. And on there, I'm going to include the Canadian Mental Health Association. It's called the Mental Health Meter. And you can actually go into that. It's about five, seven minutes. You go in to the website that I have listed on this handout. And you can take this survey yourself. And it kind of just gives you a quick little rundown of how you might be doing mental health-wise. It's more looking at the mental wellness side of things. So I just want people to agree or disagree. So if you agree, maybe we'll say if you agree, raise your hand. So I often dwell on past experiences and daydream about different outcomes. Yeah. Anybody else agree with that? So there's a few, not many. Okay. I recognize that some things can't be changed. So that's the majority. If life is a juggling act, then I think I'm a pretty good juggler. Yeah, pretty split. Yeah. I exercise regularly and eat right even when life gets busy or stressful. Yeah. And there's... I hope I don't need to say this, but this isn't meant to make you feel guilty or anything. It's just to get you thinking. Because these are all things that might, if I'd asked you 6 months ago, it might have been different. or 5 years ago, or before you were a parent, or when you still had kids living with you. There aren't enough hours in the day to accomplish everything I want to do. I know what my strengths are, and I work to develop them. Yeah, okay. That's one that gets me thinking. Life is smoother when I keep my emotions level at all times. Just not many that agree with that. I'm surprised, actually. With no judgment, but I'm surprised. I always make time for my hobbies. How many people have I said I know what my hobbies are? Yeah. That's tricky for a lot of people. We get busy. I have a great support network. Yeah. That's something we sometimes take for granted if we have it. So this is what they call the wellness wheel. If you Google wellness wheel, you'll get about 100 different versions of this. This is just one that was colorful and I liked. But yeah, there's different pieces to this. There's the emotional piece. Obviously, I'm going to spend time talking about that tonight more than probably most other parts. The intellectual side. So what does that refer to, do we think? Yeah, so I think keeping your brain stimulated, learning things, being curious about the world, about life, things like that. Physical, I think we probably can, that's probably the easiest one for people to kind of talk about, what makes somebody physically well. If you're on Facebook, you're inundated with nonstop articles about how to be healthy. And sleeping enough and using your time wisely and how many hours you have left in your life and how many books you can read. Socially, yeah, that's a big one. Social wellness, and what does that mean? And how does that change as we go through life? Any thoughts on that? Yeah, we'll talk more. Environmental, the environmental side of wellness. And we sometimes don't think about that. Sometimes we don't always have control over that. But the environmental piece, I think, actually impacts us quite a bit sometimes. Financially, I think sometimes we overemphasize this. Especially, you know, with housing the way it is and those things, though, that's a real practicality for people. And to really talk about how does wellness tie to, you know, finances and how much money we have and how much time we spend trying to make that money. And then spiritual health as well. So we're in a church, so that's something that definitely comes up. But yeah, churches don't have the monopoly on spiritual health. And I think to figure out what that looks like for people individually, and that's an interesting conversation if you just ask. If we picked 100 people off the street and asked what does spiritual wellness mean, you're going to get a lot of different answers and a lot of variety. And that might have changed in the last 24 hours, given what just happened. Okay, so life events. I'm referring to legalized marijuana. It's really dry. Okay. So life events are one of those things that are a huge, I guess I always say there's a lot of things in the world that we can control. Most things we can't. So what are some things that we can control in our world? You think of anything? Yeah?
What time you go to bed?
Yeah, there you go. So you in control a little bit of your time.
What you eat?
What you eat, usually, yeah. Pardon me? Where you go and what you spend your time doing, yeah. Exercise, yeah. Who you spend your time with.
How you accept things.
Yeah. The choice of to accept something or not. Yeah. Yeah. Your attitude? Yeah. So sometimes there's that belief that we kind of control, like, you know, a good attitude or not, right? And if you kind of stay positive, things tend to be better than if you dwell on things. So there's lots of different ways and things that we can control. What are things that we can't control?
The weather.
Yeah, that's actually really true. This time of the year starts to be it feels a little gloomier as you realize that. Yeah, what else?
When a family member or close friend passes away.
Yeah, so and another way of saying that is death, right? Yeah, it's loss. Certain things, we don't like it, but we all hopped into the stream of life and we all kind of are in that going along and we can't really control that. So that's a huge, that's probably one of the very biggest ones that we just can't control. And we don't really talk about it or even think about it that often because it's uncomfortable, but it's a big factor. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes money and how much you make or how you lose it. Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes those things happen, right? Things break, things cost money that way. There's lots of different ways that money comes and goes. Any other things? Yeah, exactly. You can't control other people at all. You can't even control your spouse, your kids even. It's hard to control them. You can influence, but we sometimes have this illusion that we can control things more than we can. Often we get really worn out when we spend time trying to control things that we can't control or that we have no business controlling. That exhausts us, but we spend time doing that. And anger, yeah? Yeah, I mean, that's sometimes when people say, you make me angry, the classic therapist answer is, you're choosing to be angry. We're not making you feel angry, right? Which is a little bit of BS, but I understand it. And I've said that to clients because I think there's a shift there. It's to get you thinking about feelings in a different way. So yeah, that's good. We'll get more to that. So life events are going to happen to all of us. And when we're talking about living a life that's filled with wellness or mental well-being, emotional well-being, we're not saying that everything's hunky-dory all the time and things are good. The whole point of this is to kind of recognize that life's going to happen. And it's kind of learning to roll with the punches, so to speak. I almost picture like riding on a bumpy road. We all have different types of shock absorbers. And to be able to absorb those shocks rather than just get beaten down right away. And there's times we get beaten down. And that's when wellness can also be really important. But learning to flourish under fire. Another piece to be aware of, I think, would be life transitions. That life transitions happen to all of us all the time. We kind of touched on these already a little bit with the idea of time. What are some life transitions that can be, I won't even say that can be anything. What are some life transitions? Aging, yeah.
Retirement.
Yeah, retirement is a big one. I have a lot of clients that really are working through retirement, depending on what your job was. Sometimes people are forced to retire before they want to. If you have a very physical job and your body's breaking down, or even if you don't have that physical job. There's that. What else? What are some other, what's that? Yeah, moving is a big one. They say that moving is one of the most stressful life events. I moved from Manitoba 5 years ago. It was okay, but it was stressful. Yeah. Learning to drive, or what do you mean by driving? Just in general driving. Yeah, I mean, I would look at that even from the angle of, yeah, when you're 16 and suddenly you're driving, that's a life transition. It opens up the world a bit. Yeah, and that's actually a really good point. No, I'm living that. I have that question a lot with my mom, whether she should still be driving, and we leave it to the doctor to kind of make that decision. But that will be a huge loss for her if that happens. Other transitions. Sorry, go ahead. What's that?
Empty
nesting. Yeah, that's a big one. That's a really big one. And when the kids leave home and go to university and all those things happen, that is a life transition for individuals, but also potentially for a marriage as well. That's a big change sometimes. Yeah. Yeah, again, caring for elderly, the kind of that circle of life that happens. Sometimes there's the in-betweeners, I think they call it, where it's like you still have kids that need care, but also that you have parents that are aging and you need to kind of, you're stuck taking care of both sides. Oh, okay, yeah, just not getting to enjoy those transitions at the time when you hope. That's a really good point. Yeah, that is good. And I've seen that a lot, where suddenly the grandkids are living with grandparents, and they'd hope to be maybe not on a yacht, but at least not waking up at 6 in the morning every day to play blocks. Yeah.
Divorce.
Yeah, divorce is a big one, too. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one. And if you've experienced that or have had close friends or family go through that, it's devastating. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, death is a big one, and that shift. Yeah.
And even marriage.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Marriage is a huge transition for people, right?
Children.
Yeah, having kids. So these are all and you guys are hitting all of them. And another one is, And this, there's some invisible transitions. Sometimes we don't think of these. For the sake of time, I should keep going. But some of them are things like I have a lot of clients, and even going through that stage myself, early 20s, late teens, early 20s can be a hugely tough time because you're trying to figure out, if you think of all the things you're navigating, trying to find maybe a life partner, trying to figure out what you're going to do for work, trying to figure out if you can move out or not, trying to separate from parents or family and move, be a little more independent. That's a really stressful time for a lot of people. I have a lot of clients that are 20, anywhere from 20 to 26 years old that are really stuck. And if you, especially if you can't afford to get out and you want to and all those things, there's a lot of stress at that time in life. So life transitions are also going to happen to everybody. There's no way to get away from that. And again, it's learning how to absorb and roll with the punches with that. Because I think sometimes I'll have people come in. I see about 15 to 20 clients a week individually. So that's my day-to-day is a therapist. And a lot of people come in after, you know, thinking about coming in for months and months, and finally they show up for therapy. And often right away it's like, actually, like I'll point out to them, you realize you're here because, you know, you're grieving the fact that you're aging, or you're struggling with the fact that you're going from high school into university, or that you're about to get married. And people don't often think, we don't have grace for ourselves. We often don't really recognize that what we're actually living is fairly stressful. We just kind of put our head down and assume that everybody else around us looks okay, so I should be okay too. But it can be really hard to navigate those transitions. Any points or questions? You can cut me off anytime. Just raise your hand, and if I don't see you, just yell. So we're going to dive into like some really practical things. Now, baby animals apparently help people to, first of all, emotionally engage, and also helps with memory. So there you go. You're going to get some baby animals over the next while because, So that's what's with the panda. So these are things. Now, if you were having this presentation or this talk from different counselors, you might have different angles. But I've tried to touch on all the big research pieces that are out there right now. And again, a lot of this stuff is not earth-shattering. A lot of this stuff you might have heard before, but it's looking at seeing it all in one place and recognizing that. There's lots of different angles to what wellness can be. A lot of stuff, too, if you look, and I'll talk a bit about this after, but happiness. People love to talk about how to be happy, the pursuit of happiness. There's all that talk. And I try not to use that word. I tend to use the word more contentment or wellness because I think happiness is just it's an emotion. It's a temporary state, whereas contentment or wellness is something that's more sustainable. So rather, but if you look, there's tons and tons of books and literature, and if you Google how to be happy, you're going to see a lot of these things. I think sometimes it's just a limit of language. Sometimes we use the word happy when really, because there's not a better word. So practicing gratitude is a big thing. It's seeing the good and the bad. So recognizing the silver linings. When things aren't going well, it's kind of trying to, our brains sometimes immediately jump to the worst case scenario. It's trying to say, okay, yeah, this isn't good. I'm not liking this. But there's also a silver lining to this. Training your brain to recognize things that you can be thankful for every day. We'll talk more about how to do that a little bit, but it's just those moments of being thankful that a certain song comes on the radio, thankful for food, thankful for a certain person, thankful for your health. Health is a big life transition, by the way, as that starts to change, and how much we take that for granted. When we lack gratitude, it's easier to see all the limitations and constraints around us, so trying to focus on sometimes on what we do have instead of what we don't have. People that see constraints all the time, and often you think of finances, that kind of thing, but also there's lots of other stuff. Social media is really good at kind of wrecking our gratitude. When you see other people that have stuff, when you see other people that are on amazing trips, when you see other people whose kids are perfect, these are things that, or somebody's kids are going to an Ivy League school, all these things are happening. And actually, they say social media is not great to be on sometimes because it does actually wreck. People generally have a lower mood when they get off because you're comparing. It's a lot of comparing. And it doesn't breed gratitude. It's not just about money. Things like having a gratitude journal, and that's as simple as just who has time to do that. But if you just sit down and write down four or five things at the end of the day that you are thankful, or just think about it. You don't need to write it down. But just trying to kind of start training your brain to think of those little moments where you're like, that's really good. Like, that was a really bad day, but that was a good moment. Yeah. You had a question? Not? I thought I saw your arm do this. Okay. Practice intentional thankfulness. Living with gratitude encourages an outward focus, so it helps us to think about others. It helps us to be aware of what other people are experiencing too. It's empathy. And being aware of that woe is me kind of feeling like a victim, because we can get like that sometimes. That's okay. I mean, you're always going to have these ups and downs, but trying to recognize it, and then gratitude can help pull you out of that too. Some days you're allowed to just be sad and angry, but sometimes it's to say, hey, I don't have it as bad as that person. And you got to be careful with that, but sometimes that's helpful. Pursuing your interests. And there's a penguin. My hard drive crashed on Sunday, so I called my wife at work and said, can you find me a bunch of baby animals? And then she emailed me these. So these are from my wife, because I had no hard drive and I was seeing clients all day. So happy people know what they enjoy and they spend time doing it. That sounds really silly, but it's true. People that know what they like and they actually build it into their life somehow, even if it's tiny, they find some more joy or contentment with life sometimes. Think about what you enjoyed as a child. Things like I'll speak for myself. I was really ingrained with, if it wasn't going to take me places, if it wasn't going to be valuable, not just monetarily, but, you know, if it didn't have a lot of value to it, then it probably wasn't worth doing. You know, something like painting or playing the piano or even playing hockey. Some of those things like, oh, I'm not going to make the NHL, so I'm just not going to play anymore. I'm not painting because I'm not going to be who makes money being an artist very often. But it's looking at that's actually the point. It's about what you're doing and how much you enjoy it. It's not about whether it's worth it or if there's an inherent value to it, because we only do things if it's worth it, right? And the value is that you enjoy it and you like it. That's all that it needs to have. Does that make sense? Yeah. Do people have those activities that they do now in this room? Like, are there some people that can name some things they do? Yeah? Yeah, and video games can be one, for sure. There's lots of different ones, but that's one that a lot of people spend time doing. Yeah, you do? Yeah, thankfully I can ride every day to work, and that is actually my thing. Yeah, singing's great. Yeah. All of those things can be... Yeah. All those things that we enjoy. So it doesn't need to be something you do well. You can be really crummy at it, but if you like it, I mean, that's okay. Just enjoy doing it and let go. Don't let money limit you. So if it's something that you just, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, my bike was $100. It'd be great to have a $5,000 bike, but I'm just as happy riding my bike. What was that? Or do you had something?
Yeah. Yeah?
Yeah, sometimes you might not do that. You might, you know, just explore Ontario or, yeah, if you can. Thinking about things intellectually, what might be an interest to you. Physically, like physical activity. Spiritually, there's lots you can pursue that way as well. Practically, you know, if it's like I want to learn how to fix, like do plumbing so that I can fix stuff in my house. I mean, that might be an interest that you want to pursue. Or impractically, like stuff we've already mentioned, maybe it doesn't necessarily have that value. Or socially. It builds competency, confidence, and creativity. So it just gets you excited about things. It's just that idea of having a purpose, something to get out of bed for and be excited about in the morning is valuable. Am I always in the way for you? I'm just avoiding the bright light. That's why I'm standing over here. And then what do you want to learn or master? So another thing would be developing a routine that works for you and for your family, if there's other people that kind of interact in your circle. So structure is actually a really good thing. I think we need to have some type of structure. If I don't know if you think back to a time in life where you didn't have a lot of activity that you had to do or a lot of things, and also sometimes in retirement that happens. It's trying to figure out how do I structure my day so I have things that I'm enjoying and doing. Planning ahead to decrease your mental load. So sometimes, you know, we get overwhelmed with all the decisions in a day that we have to make. And sometimes if you just plan ahead, you know, like, this is what we're going to have for dinner tonight, so I don't need to think about it. Pack my lunch for tomorrow, so that's done, so I don't have to race around in the morning and do that. Those are little things, but they it kind of make your morning go better, and you're not as frantic. Things like laying out what you're going to wear the next day. Like, it sounds funny, but that stuff goes a long way. Planning your route before you're going somewhere, so you're not panicking, like, with your phone on the dashboard trying to figure it out in the bright sun. Stopping willpower fatigue. So willpower... If we rely on willpower to either do something we don't want to do or not do something we don't want to do, there's this thing called willpower fatigue. Over the course of a day, we start out really strong in the morning with like, no, it's going to be a good day. I'm not going to do that. Or I'm going to work out or whatever you're going to do. As the day goes on, as we make all those micro decisions and things happen, we get this fatigue that sets in so that by the end of the day, we're more likely or less likely to do what we intended to do because our brains just get tired. We're just human, right? So sometimes we underestimate that. Striving for balance, and I'll talk about balance later, but a balance between, you know, things like sleep, work, fitness, family, and friends. That's just five that I put on there. There is a book that Randy Zuckerberg wrote about the idea of picking three if you want to do those well. And she says in general, but I think in any given day even, pick three. You can't do everything at once. Schedule downtime, just time to laugh, time to hang out, time to sit and watch Netflix is good. I think sometimes we spend a lot more time doing that than we should, but be intentional with that. If you're going to sit and watch Netflix, plan it. Don't just sit down for 3 hours and do it and then realize you had 100 other things you could have done. You could have watched it for 1 hour and got other stuff done. Leave time for fun and don't spend too much time online. And I think that's self-explanatory, so I won't say much more. But we can kill a lot of time. Depending on who you are, we can spend a lot of time on YouTube or Facebook or all those types of things. What's that? Yeah, all those things. And again, they've done studies about how when you stop doing that, your mood is actually lower than it was. If you got out with a hippo. that's my favorite. So physical health is important. I'm not going to say much about this, but sleep is a huge one, and we don't think of sleep that often. How many people struggle with sleeping? Yeah, I have struggled my whole life, ever since I was a small child. I have so many nights where I lie there and I cannot sleep. You can't get the brain to shut off. I always say, like, as soon as my head hits the pillow, the committee in my brain starts to have meetings about everything that I'm worried about. During the day, I'm cool, calm, and collected, and I won't even realize something's bothering me. And then as soon as my head hits the pillow, it's off to the races. So sleep hygiene, things like not looking at screens. I have, like, a light on my computer that's supposed to make it less likely that the blue light from the screen interacts with your brain and makes it harder to sleep. I don't know if it actually works. There's no actual studies on whether that works or not. But things like when you put a small child to bed, what are some things you do? You read quietly, you talk quietly, you turn the lights down, you give them, you know, time to wind down. We need to do that for ourselves as well. And it sounds like common sense, but yeah, it's really fun to go full steam and then just try and shut off the lights and go to bed. And it doesn't always work. Some people can do it. My wife's asleep in 4 seconds and I'm lying there chatting to myself. Really, I am. Accepting limitations. There's certain things you just can't do. What physically, you know, your body might limit you on certain things. All that. But just trying to still... it might be something like even as far as finances. They might not be able to afford certain food, those kind of things. Finding out what works for you. You know, think outside the box. You don't need to run a marathon or pump iron. You know, we sometimes go... As soon as you hear fitness, you think of... you know, Lycra and bicycles and people lifting weights. And honestly, just go for a walk. Just get moving. Just do something. I have so many clients, I'm just trying to get them to walk around the block. So, and shut the video games off for like 20 minutes. you are what you eat. So again, you know, diet, that can be controversial, but just try and be aware, right? You know, mindful eating, you know. Choose what you eat. If you're going to eat sugar, thoroughly enjoy it. I love sugar. But, you know, also there's that study that if you eat a bowl of ice cream every day versus once a week, you enjoy the bowl of ice cream a lot more if it's once a week. Learning to cook can be fun. I'm starting to like that more now. And examining your relationship with alcohol and other substances. So, yeah, that's a big one. I've spent a lot of my career talking around substance use. I won't say a ton about that, but alcohol... and other drugs, they're psychoactive, meaning that they affect the way we think, feel, and act. And so if you get that question, why do you drink, you know, what are some answers to that? Yeah, so it's just the joy factor, it's a pleasurable experience, yeah? Well, yeah, you can, yeah. What are some reasons people might do it, though? Yeah, so people see it as just a relaxant, right? You sit down and have a glass of wine or a beer after work, or yeah? Yeah. Yeah, and there's a difference. Often we get hung up on how much, too. But it's really kind of this question of what is your relationship with alcohol or other drugs like? If it's, you know, there's the levels of you can be dependent on it. If you feel like every time you get angry or every time you feel emotionally worked up, your impulses to drink. That's a different way of looking at it than having a glass of wine, you know, with dinner. So with marijuana, you know, I think some people are talking like the sky's falling, and other people it's not any change at all for them. You know, I don't think, yeah, we're not going to get into like that whole thing. But the reality is that a lot of people use different substances to kind of, well, they use it every day. And sometimes people don't realize that there's a lot more of an emotional piece to that maybe than that. And that doesn't mean that everybody that uses those things is using it as an emotional crutch either. Serving and giving to others is important. So we're just talking generosity. So this encourages connection with other people. It decreases isolation. It gets you out of your shell. It increases a sense of purpose, kind of seeing things, the bigger worldview in a different way. It increases empathy for other people when we're generous. When we start thinking about how can I be generous to others, not just with money, right, but with time and things we can do with that. It increases teamwork. It's just social. We're social beings, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it just has us thinking about the world in different ways. Spending time with supportive people, that's my favorite. I forgot about that one. That's better, the koala. So we're wired for connection. So I don't know, are there any therapists in the room? No? So attachment theory is like a really big thing. That's what we work on. Shalem is very much, as my clinical supervisor says, we've drank the Kool-Aid on that. So attachment theory is very much that human beings are wired for connection. We are wired. People fear being alone often more than death. You can make that argument. People do not like it. And so we need people. We have this loneliness epidemic sometimes that's happening, I think. And in the UK now, there's this social prescribing that's happening where doctors, and it's already been talked about with the Ministry of Health here, around prescribing people getting out to go to different events to be around people of all ages. I have a lot of people in their 20s that do not do much, that don't get out, that are scared, that don't work. A lot of seniors, though, that also struggle with that to get out for a whole different, whole bunch of different reasons. But there is this epidemic of, I think, people spending a lot of time alone. Being alone is not bad, but when it limits us, it can really be damaging. Did anybody see that study about how loneliness impacts health? They're saying now more than smoking and obesity. Yeah, that was just a few weeks ago. But yeah, that tells you how powerful that is. And there's lots of different community groups, you know, schools, work or at job. For a lot of people, work is often their primary social outlet. A lot of people, especially if you've moved for a job and you don't know that many people where you are, often work is a big, important place for people. There's different things like meetup groups. When I first moved to Ontario, I was doing that, where I'd just go online and like a meetup for a cycling, like just meet a bunch of people in a parking lot, and then you just go for a ride and you get to know people that way. Advocacy groups, different activities, support groups, community groups, all these different things are out there. If you have that support network already, be really thankful for that and don't take it for granted, because it's really important. As we go through life, I think that shifts. When you're in school and university and those kind of things, those people just happen to be around you, and it's easier to have friends and do that. But as people get busy and have kids and things happen, sometimes those circles dwindle. Yeah, and there's the stereotype that men tend to rely on their spouse more for meeting those social needs, and I think there's some truth to that. Not always, but sometimes we need to reach outside of our own house too. And limit time with people who are draining. You know, you don't need to be around everybody all the time, and set limits with those people. And, you know, you can be generous with people and spend time with people, but if they're draining you, sometimes you need to set those limits and say, okay, I can't do certain activities with that person. Maybe we only watch movies, or we only do a certain activity because it's easier to be around them. Staying organized is really important. So making lists to reduce mental load. So again, that kind of mental load I talked about earlier with deciding things ahead of time. Having a worry list can be really helpful. Has anybody done that? If you have, I don't know, can people relate with, at any given point, you have 100 things in your head that you kind of are thinking about or need to do? Yeah. What's that? Yeah, I've done it. I'll do it at night if I'm lying there in the committee's meeting, and I start thinking of things I need to do, and it can range from big health things all the way to to small things like I got to pay a bill or whatever, I got to email someone. But trying to make a list of those things and then checking it off, and it helps to it. Basically, you're putting it into a you're taking it out of your brain, putting it onto a place, and then you can kind of your brain can relax. You're not going to forget it. It's okay, but that can be a really good tool. Use technology to stay organized, or maybe don't. Sometimes that actually makes it worse. So figure out what works for you. You know, budgeting is really important. I'm not going to get tons into that, but that's a huge part of mental wellness. If you can barely afford your house, barely pay the bills, all those things are happening. That's going to have a massive impact on your mental wellness. Let's be honest. If you're stressing every single month from paycheck to paycheck, if anything breaks or something happens and you're going to be not able to afford it, that is a huge impact. So trying to figure out how to do that, be realistic about that, and budgeting your time as well, trying to use that well. I always say I get better and better managing my time the less I have. Now that I have kids, I'm way more efficient with time. Before I had kids, you just blow time all the time because you have hours and hours that you can do, you can waste. Prioritize and maybe even give up certain things. If you just can't fit everything, maybe at times you have to set things aside. Being realistic about what you can do. Declutter is a big one. If your desk is a mess, if your garage is a mess, if your bedroom's a mess or your countertops, just cleaning that up can sometimes take. It's really good for mental wellness just to do that. Don't micromanage. If it's something that somebody else can do, sometimes you have to delegate. No questions? Okay. Knowing your values, and that's an interesting one, but it's kind of knowing what is important to you. What are some values people would have? So integrity, I heard, and honesty. Yeah, yeah. What else? Empathy. Yeah. What else? It can be like tangible things or intangible, like. Pardon me?
Charity.
Yeah. Yeah, valuing that part of society, valuing spending time doing that or giving money or whatever that looks like, time. Yeah. Yeah, faith is a big one, I think, yeah. And faith can look like a lot of different things for people. But, I think I always say I probably actually wouldn't do this job if it wasn't for faith. That's for me. There's lots of people that would do this type of work. But I think that was really formative for me growing up as I was trying to decide what I was going to do with my life. Yeah, so it can really impact your view of the world. Any other big ones I'm missing? Yeah.
Friendships.
Yeah, friendships is big too.
What about nature? Spending some time in nature.
Yeah, I think that's really big. Yeah.
Respect.
Yeah, respect is another one. Yeah.
Loving God and loving others.
Yeah. Yeah, and loving God, loving others and how that translates into action. Values will naturally lead to action. It's, you know, the way we spend our time. We might say we really value something, but if we never make time for it, or we're living kind of outside of that, I think pressure starts to build over time. You know, and this is a really extreme example, but if you really value your spouse and being married and you're cheating on them, that's, over time, that causes a lot of pressure. And I know that sounds like maybe an extreme example, but that's some people's reality, right? There's lots of different ways that works. If we value health, which I think we all do on some level, but you know, you're smoking or drinking a lot or never exercising or some of those things we know we should do, that over time creates some sort of tension and we kind of feel like, oh, maybe I should be doing that more. Yeah, there's 1,000 different things that you can value. Any last ones that nobody said that they wanted to? No? Okay. Yeah, I think outside the box on that one, because it can be almost anything. I mean, you can value family, you can value respect within a family, trust within the family. Yeah, there's lots of those things. And some, I did have it there, the miracle question. So if you did have, say, $1 million, which doesn't go as far as it used to, but if you had $1 million in a year off, what would you do? Or what do you wish you could spend more energy on? Or what do you wish you could spend less energy on? Those are some ways of getting to the root of that. And you'll get these on a handout. So this is where I want to spend a bit of time. So increasing emotional intelligence. Emotional awareness is very important. And I think it's, you know, there's studies out there now. There used to be the classic, there's 6 different emotions. They did studies on that. Now there's, you know, new ones that say there's 27 different distinct emotions. You can just Google it. But either way, there are a lot of different emotions. Before I lost my slideshow and my hard drive crashed, I had a really nice slide, which I couldn't get back, of all the different emotions that we experience in different in a big circle. And there was had to be over 100 on there of different types of things that we feel. So if you're ever just driving or walking to work or on the bus and you start thinking, okay, what am I feeling right now? Is that an easy thing to identify? Yeah, for some people? Yeah. What about others? Is that sometimes hard? I find that really hard. I'm a counselor, for crying out loud, and I find that hard. Like, it's not always easy to think. Like, am I feeling content? Am I frustrated? Do I have that pent-up energy? Do I have awkwardness? Do I have, shame? Do I have pride? There's lots of different emotions if you start thinking about it. And even if you Google a big list of them and just look at them and say, how often do I feel some of these? And what are my defaults? Like, sometimes we, you know, it's easy to be irritable or grumpy sometimes, or depending on the day. I know that it's better if I don't talk a lot in the morning, because when I wake up, I'm just a little grumpy. They actually say don't listen to the news for the first hour of your morning, which is when we all listen to the news. But you're a little more vulnerable to bad news. You're a little more vulnerable to be grumpy. You can get that, like, the world sucks kind of feeling when you start listening to things in the morning. So that's a way you can kind of protect yourself emotionally, because it's almost like your shell's not on yet, and you're traumatizing yourself, depending on the news. So emotions provide information about how we're interacting with the world around us. This is a silly way of putting it, but sometimes it's helpful. If I'm sitting here with a saw and I start sawing on my leg, obviously that's going to hurt really bad. We wouldn't say, hey, should I be feeling this right now? You're like, this hurts because I'm cutting my flesh with a saw. But if you're, you know, emotionally, we can be feeling really sad or depressed or joyful or lots of different feelings, lonely. And we often invalidate that. We don't really recognize it, or we shut that down, and we don't really think about, hey, this is how I'm feeling right now, and maybe this is why. We often try to escape those feelings. I try to shut it down. Yeah. That's a good question. Yeah, I think often you'd use it interchangeably. Your mood could fluctuate, just like emotions can. So, yeah, I think that's the simple way I'd answer it right now. Yeah, I would say mood and emotions would be pretty similar. Yeah, moods might not be as severe sometimes, or maybe, you know, you could still be feeling in a good mood but not, or have a happy feeling or a good feeling, but maybe just, you can still be happy and not want to be around people, you know. So I guess it depends. There's emotions and then there's the behavior. We'll talk a bit about that too, but emotions don't always, you can say, hey, that person's in a bad mood, but they might not be. It's tough to tell sometimes. Any other questions? No. Yeah, so learning to recognize and accept how we feel rather than judging whether the feeling is valid or not. Often people will come in for counseling and they'll be so stressed and worked up, and kind of like I said before, we'll say, well, that's actually a big life transition, or that sounds like that's really upsetting what's going on right now, or that seems stressful. And you see the look in people's eyes when they're like, I hadn't thought of it like that. And it seems so simple, but we do this all the time. We just get so tunnel vision and so focused on our own lives. We don't actually say to ourselves, hey, is this okay that I'm feeling this way? Maybe I'm stressed for a reason. Maybe I'm just tired. Maybe I'm hungry. There's lots of different things that impact that. So it's important to honor our emotions. And that sounds maybe kind of hokey to say it that way, but I think it's really true. It's learning to kind of recognize and validate. And validate means to say, yeah, this is how I'm feeling. Emotions can cause us to feel out of control, but they're not a sign of weakness. I think it's on the next slide, but can you name some masculine emotions and some feminine emotions for me?
Feminine compassion.
Okay. And I've set a trap for you, by the way. Yeah. But anyway. that's very helpful, because you're right. Typically, you're going to see that. And is my wife more compassionate to our kids than I am? Yeah, probably. Where does that come from? That's a good question. If you look at anger, is that more socially acceptable for men or women? Typically, probably men. I think that's more the default. I remember when my kids were really young, feeling really angry. Like, I'm talking really young, like little babies. Being angry because, and I was trying to figure it out, it's because that loss of control of time. Like, you know, you're trying to go to sleep or you're trying to, you know, read a book or whatever, and you realize, like, it's not, you're not actually angry, but it's that frustration of losing control of something. So there's often emotions underneath that. But we, for men, often, and I don't always like talking like that because you can, it's generalizations, but often from my experience and things beyond that, men often are more uncomfortable with strong displays of emotion than women are. I am a counselor again, and I can count on one hand the number of times I've cried in the past 15 years. It's very rare. It's like when my daughter was born, when I got married, there's a couple times, but there's not many times that I've let myself cry. My wife cries all the time, and I think that's okay. You know, and I think that's probably fairly normal for a lot of people. So I think it's trying to recognize emotions are not a sign of weakness. And there's, whether you're stoic on the outside and you look fine and you look in control, because, again, a lot of people, I mean, my mom is very much stoic and not very emotional, actually. So there's always exceptions, tons of them. But that idea that there's still huge emotions going on in people, even if they're not showing it, right? And to be aware of that, that there's not this idea of masculine and feminine emotions, that we all experience that full gamut of those emotions. There's surface emotions, and so things like anger and happiness are ones that are more socially acceptable to show. So if you have like road rage or something, I mean, that's, you know, but often there's emotions under that. And I was trying to think of examples. If I'm riding my bike and I have cars cutting me off and doing things, I get angry. But then I start to think about it. I'm angry because I'm really scared because I don't want to get killed. So that's exactly what's going on. I'm not angry. I'm very scared. So I try to avoid busy streets. There's often deeper feelings under a lot of things, you know, whether it's embarrassment, whether it's shame. Shame causes us to isolate. It causes us to turn inward and avoid other people. But on the outside, sometimes shame comes out like anger, or we blame other people, or we yell at people. And you watch kids, they're not as good at hiding these things. And you can kind of see how they feel. Any questions about that? Does that make sense when I say surface emotions versus the emotions underneath that? Is anybody like kind of lost on that, or is it? Yeah, I think it's pretty intuitive once you hear it, but we don't often think about it. And it's not saying that you need to go around and show your deep underlying emotions all the time either. I think that, you know, there's a time and a place where we feel safe and where we can share those things. But yeah, it's to also kind of be aware, even if you are feeling that way. Okay, this is what's going on underneath here. Honoring your emotions, I said, thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior. So that kind of comes out of cognitive behavioral therapy. But it's the idea that often the thoughts we have about the world, we interpret situations all the time. You know, if Mark's sitting looking at me like with a brow furrowed right now, I could have this in my head like, oh, he doesn't like what I'm saying at all. This is not the kind of presentation he wanted. And I could start worrying about that. And I think thoughts can be all over the place. But then if I took that and I get that feeling of like, oh, now I feel embarrassed that I'm not quite talking how we were supposed to go, the behavior could be that I start to close up, or that I start to, like, you know, talk differently, or cut the presentation short, like, you know, shut things down faster. So there's lots of different ways how we interpret behavior around us all the time. And I think it's to be aware of how we're interpreting it. It's checking the facts. Often, you know, things that we interpret that we feel are impacting us are not actually about us at all. Any examples that anybody can think of around that? If you do, cut me off, because I'm curious if you think of any. Because there's lots of different things about that. I mean, one that I thought of is, you know, if you say you apply for a job and you don't get it, you can be really upset about that. I mean, like, oh, you know, I tried the best I can. I didn't get the job. Things always go bad. And, you know, that can cause that feeling of inadequacy, that feeling of anger maybe, which can lead to maybe less likely to apply for certain jobs, or you know, feeling kind of cocooning. But another way of looking at that is maybe they just hired someone that was more qualified and I got to apply for another job, you know, like looking at it in that way. What's that? Well, that's the cynical way, yeah, but it's to say, like, you know, there's all different ways of interpreting things, and sometimes we can get in those thought patterns where we always see the negative, and that really affects our emotions, which will affect our behavior. We all have our limits. Emotional displays often, I talked about this, so feelings are often seen as irrational. They're not. They're completely rational. And we try to talk in terms of uncomfortable and comfortable emotions rather than saying positive or negative, because there's no negative emotions. They feel uncomfortable to feel, But it's actually, emotions just give us information. They're helpful, and they're good, and we should embrace them. Okay, so name that emotion. And it's, I'm checking the time. So 8:27. If I go a few more minutes, are we good with that? Yeah? Okay. Name that emotion. So we got somebody with butterflies in their stomach, a pounding heart, sweating profusely, difficulty sleeping, not profusely, racing thoughts, pent up energy, maybe feeling dizzy, muscle tension. So what emotion is that? So I hear fear, anxiety, which are similar. Apprehension, nervousness. What else? Stress. Yeah. What about, yeah, those are all good. And I think those tend to be, what about that makes it look like anxiety or fear? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What on there makes us think that it's not something like, say, anger? Yeah. Sometimes it depends. I actually looked it up because I was curious just to see what would come up. And what I did, I looked up feelings of anger, like physiological responses to anger. And this was, all of these were on both lists, is what I'm saying. Anger, excitement, and anxiety. So I purposely chose ones from each of those that were the same. So that's not necessarily going to fit for everybody, for sure. I mean, the butterflies in the stomach. I'm trying to think of a time when I've been really angry. And yeah, I think you just feel that immense, can everybody relate with that immense physiological rush that you feel? Most people can tune into that. Anger's probably the easiest one to feel. Anxiety would be another one. If you are thinking of a time when you were really excited or anticipating something, can you think of a time? No? Nobody gets excited? Sure, yeah, a wedding or your wedding or whatever, yes. Yeah, night before a big trip is great. Sorry? Sure, winning the lottery. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good one. Public speaking. That build up that you feel beforehand, trying to get amped up and be excited, but also hoping it goes well and that your brain works and all that. Yeah. What else? Yeah, those are all great examples. I mean, the classic one I think of is, for some kids, probably not everybody had this experience, but that feeling of like a kid on Christmas Eve, like not being able to like relax, the idea of maybe going on like water slides or a roller coaster or something for kids, like that real excitement that comes from that. As adults, it's different, right? It might depend if you're a sports fan, it could be watching a big game, or there's all different things, right? But yeah, if you think about that, the whole point is that often, this is the take-home point, we get those same physiological kind of responses for different feelings. How we experience it is based on the context and how we're thinking about it. So the example is somebody said they went on a roller coaster and they loved roller coasters. So they were very excited and they experienced a lot of these things. Then they decided to try and think their way into being scared and not wanting to go on it. And you get a lot of those same responses. The fear response is very similar to the excitement response, but it's the cues that we interpret and the situation. So that might take a little bit to wrap your head around, but I think there's a lot of truth to that. It's the way our thinking interprets what we're experiencing. Is there anybody that wants to argue that or has any problems with that? I'm kind of curious. No? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And I think there's actually interesting with anxiety. There's good anxiety, and somebody said this before. Well, kind of with the hot stove thing. There's good anxiety and bad anxiety, if we want to call it that. But helpful anxiety, like functional anxiety, and dysfunctional anxiety. So yeah, to get up out of bed to go to work, there's an anxiety of like, oh crap, I got to catch the bus, I got to get there. That's a good level of anxiety, or I got to write a test, and there's a lot of anxiety around that, or doing public speaking, or if you're doing like a speech at a wedding or something. But there's also the dysfunctional anxiety where it shuts you down and paralyzes you, and you're not able to kind of do something that you need to be able to do because of that. Yeah, you're right in some level. Yeah, yeah. And that's where you can do some work with people. There are a lot of people that barely leave their house because of that anxiety, and there's not really anything that you can identify for that. So, yeah, how many people saw that movie? If you have young kids or been around kids at all, you might have seen it. But, yeah, so it was Inside Out in the movie. It was actually a really cool movie. If you want to watch it, it's good for adults. But there was the five different characters, happy, anger, worry, disgust, and sadness. And it was, they were inside this girl's head, and it was showing how she, as she aged, she became like from a little child to kind of more junior high, how those feelings and emotions were working in her brain. And I think it's the idea that as we get older, we start to get used to holding more than one emotion in our head at the same time. That's actually really complicated. That whole thing that happens developmentally from when you're a child till as you get older, very young children will probably only feel one emotion at once, or express it only at once. That's why a kid who's screaming and crying, you can suddenly pull out some puppet and do this and they'll start laughing because they're not aware. That doesn't work anymore. So it's that idea of emotion. So happiness is not achieved by the conscious pursuit of happiness. It is generally the byproduct of other activities. So I kind of said that before, but people that have some level of happiness or contentment know what they like to do and they pursue that. But it's also lots of other things that we've been talking about. There's this happiness myth. I think, again, we can't be happy all the time. Our brains are complicated. Emotion comes from our brains, and it comes from the experiences around us. And all of these different neurotransmitters are going to impact how we're experiencing the world. So, I probably won't go through all of these, but each of these are going to have different impacts on mood. And it's impossible to feel happy every day, just like you can't feel sad every day. If somebody is feeling sad every day, or say clinical depression, that kind of thing, that's where they might do an antidepressant, which typically impacts serotonin, which is the self-esteem and sleep chemical. But also, basically, it's the mood. I don't actually like how they worded it on there. I'd call it more of a mood stabilizer. And so that's where they'll give you serotonin reuptake inhibitors to help your brain to produce more serotonin to stabilize your mood and bring you up. So there's all sorts of different ones. Oxytocin is the love chemical, the trust and love chemical. Melatonin's for sleep, R&R, norepinephrine's excitement. Dopamine's a really big one, and that's the reward cycle. So that's like things like food, sex, exercise, all the things that kind of drive us, the appetites that we have. Dopamine is kind of what gets us to do those things. So there's lots there, and happiness is not something you can maintain all the time. This comes out of dialectical behavior therapy, which is something I did a bunch of training in about 5 years ago. It's one kind of way, and I use this with a lot of different clients, but I do use this with a lot of men, particularly, who at first struggle to tune into, and it's good for people that struggle to tune into the emotions. It's kind of saying we have a rational mind, we have like the logic and the values and that part. This could be titled states of mind, by the way. So the rational mind, it approaches, knowledge and intellect. It thinks logically, uses past experience, facts, all that. So it tends to be seen as, rational. Often we put this up on a pedestal and say people that are rational are, almost more in control or more aware of things. We look at the emotional side of things as sometimes more irrational, less logical, more reactive. But if we look at it, the emotional mind is really powerful too. And if you're way over here in rational mind and shutting down the emotions all the time, what's gonna happen? What do you think?
You're gonna step on your own.
Yeah, you won't be validating how you're feeling. You won't be very in tune with how you're interacting with the world. You'll be kind of tone deaf, not only for other people, but for yourself. And also, you're often putting facts and all that above emotions, which can lead to a lot of problems. It's not going to make it easy to live with other people. Well, yeah, it would be very hard to be around someone that's always so cold and rational, right? If you're always way, way over an emotional mind, what happens? A lot of reaction. We use the word emotional dysregulation. So if you're dysregulated, all the time. Yeah, it's very stressful. It's very up and down. It's, and also on a personal level, not even how it affects other people, but we get really impulsive. And so we act in really damaging ways sometimes. We can do some really bad things. I mean, you think of the most angry you've ever been and the worst way you ever reacted. We've all slammed doors or driven too fast or yelled at people or said things that we would never say. We're looking at trying to have a balance of those things and say, okay, what's your wise mind saying? And wise mind is usually, it's kind of intuitive. It's a balance of both, and it's living mindfully. It's kind of being aware, okay, I got these really big storming emotions going on. I also am somewhat aware of the facts and what I want to be doing here. How do I kind of marry these two? And sometimes it's actually learning to ride that wave down, like waiting for that emotion to come down, because we're all down here right now in a level space. So we've all been up here at different points, and you're always going to come back down. It's just a matter of how much time it takes. And sometimes you just need to kind of take care of yourself and bide your time until. And that's one of those things, like, don't let the sun, what they say, like, don't let the sun go down on your anger and that kind of thing. Sometimes it's better to wait rather than to solve an argument while you're still way over an emotional mind. If you have two people that are in an emotional mind and you're trying to talk it out, good luck. It's going to be a big mess. Also, different people come down at different speeds. Some people stay angry for a full day before they're ready to kind of come down. And it's not them being stubborn necessarily. It's partly that physiology we were talking about. Some people, their heart rate will stay up higher. Some people are going to feel that rage, that muscle tension, all of that stuff longer than other people. And some people, after 20 minutes, it's like nothing happened. And they're like, why are you still thinking about this? Like, we're fine. Don't worry about it. So you need to kind of have grace for the people around you and how they figure that out. And if you're married, that's something that it's helpful to have that understanding of how your spouse or your kids, how they react. Because, I mean, one of my daughters is this all the time, huge emotions, and then she's fine. And my other daughter is probably more like me, where she'll go up or down, but it takes longer to kind of figure out what she's feeling. Any questions about that? Is that valuable for people, or is that helpful to think of? Yeah, I love this. Like, I think this is really, really, really cool if you think about it. Like, often you'll say, like, what's my wise mind saying right now? How do I make this decision? You know, without belaboring it, but you can think of, say, if there is suddenly, a household decides to make a budget, and somebody's like, oh, we're spending too much money, we're always in debt every month, we need to make a budget, we got to get out a spreadsheet, we're going to sit down here with the laptop and do this budget. That appears to be a very rational thing. Why are we doing that at that point? Yeah. Yeah, that's good budget advice. What I'll say is, it's coming out of fear. You're at that point where you're like, man, we're gonna be in serious financial trouble if we don't get a rein on this. So making a spreadsheet and sitting down and doing all that is a very logical thing to do. However, the entire driving force of that is the emotion of fear and that understanding that, yeah, I don't want this to get to the point where we can't survive anymore. Does that make sense? Same with if you're buying a house or if you're buying, I don't know, if you're buying anything, you weigh it out. Like, rationally, I know I can't afford this. Emotionally, I really want to buy this. And you know, nowadays with credit, emotional mind wins a lot, which is not always serving us well. But it's best not to make big decisions when you're in emotional mind. And it's also good to not just focus on rational, because sometimes there might be a reason why. So mindfulness, have people heard the term mindfulness quite a bit? Has anybody just not heard that? Okay, it's pretty in the zeitgeist right now. It's pretty common that people are talking about this. Mindfulness is not the idea of relaxation. Mindfulness, a simple way of saying it, is learn to be where your feet are. So in the moment where you are, trying to experience what you're actually doing. If you're out for a walk, well, this is me. If I'm sleeping, this is my brain. And what I want to have is sheep. So it's really trying to limit all that stuff and trying, and the brain's not very good at doing two things at once. I think that's partly why it's a problem at night for me, because I don't have a lot of other things for my brain to do. During the day, you can keep busy, you can do things, you can read, you can listen to, I always like the radio on, like, it's hard, we don't do well with silence. But being mindful is kind of really getting into that moment and understanding it. And you can be mindful sitting in a waiting room at a doctor's office for 2 hours, or at the hospital, or if you're at the Service Ontario and you have no control and you have to sit there and wait. You can be mindful of that. You can be mindful that it's not fun, that you don't want to be there, and actually it's not going to kill you. You'll be okay. Or you can just get impatient and storm up to the window every 20 minutes and ask how long it's going to be, right? That's not actually a mindful way of doing that. There's a reason why when you sit on a, if you're in an airplane and you're sitting on the tarmac for 2 hours, some people are yelling and complaining to the stewardess the entire time. Stewardess is such an old word, I'm sorry, flight attendant. People are complaining, where'd that come from? But they're complaining. And other people are just sitting there kind of zen-like and like, I can't control this, so I'm going to accept that we're sitting here and I can't do anything about it and I'm going to try and keep busy. That's a really different focus. And you can actually have that approach with life, that idea that, okay, I have to accept some things. Or you can pick a lot of fights, but it gets tiring. So almost there. Five senses grounding. Anybody heard of this? Some, they're teaching this in schools a lot now, actually. You guys heard of it? No? Nobody over here? Okay. So it's the idea that when we're feeling emotionally worked up, and again, I want you to try and think of emotions not as just this thing out here. Emotions are something, that mind-body-soul connection. Emotions are reflected in our bodies. Does that make sense? Like that excitement you feel on a Friday afternoon because you get to go home. Or long weekend's coming. Or, you know, it's Monday morning and you wake up. You feel those emotions in you. You're having an argument with someone and you feel those emotions in you. Start trying to tune into that, because most people don't tune into that. I didn't think of that before. When I was younger, I definitely never thought of it like that. Things like every emotion has some real physical cues to it. And we can learn to kind of ride that wave, because what our instinct is to just escape those right away. As soon as we start to feel that, some people, there's a reason that some people smoke weed or drink every day, because every time they feel anxious at all, or every time they get in an argument, or every time they feel any kind of stress, you know, they take a pill or they drink, because they wouldn't say, I'm doing that to physiologically cope. But that's exactly what they're doing. And you look at alcohol, how does alcohol impact the body? What does it do to the body physiologically? Yeah, it's a depressant. Doesn't mean it makes you depressed. What it means is it relaxes the body. It slows down the central nervous system. So your heart rate slows down, your breathing slows down. So that's why it makes sense that anxious people like to drink, because it actually kind of feels like it works. But it doesn't. In the long run, it really causes a lot of damage. But that's, you can see how we do this all the time. We pull at our senses and we impact and manipulate our physiology all the time. You do it with food. You sit down and that dopamine rush sitting down to like a plate of nachos or you know, a box of chocolate or whatever, that's physiological arousal that you're feeling. That's really powerful. They've done brain scans. Sugar and cocaine actually have a very similar reaction in the brain. So there's a reason that you crave that stuff and your mouth waters when you start thinking of it, depending on what your vice is. And it's okay to enjoy certain things sometimes, but try to be aware of why you're doing it in that moment. If you're sitting down and having, you know, five beers on a Wednesday night, probably there's more to it than just, hey, I just really like the taste of beer. But that's what a lot of people will say. They really will. They'll say, I just like beer. And I'll say, okay, you know, let's try and go a weekend without drinking. And some people can't do it. And believe it or not, there's a lot of people. And I think that gets hidden sometimes. That happens in the church too. That happens a lot. I work with a lot of clients that attend church regularly. There's a lot of stuff that we sometimes don't talk about. So that's why I sometimes talk about it, even though some people might feel like it doesn't affect them. So this five senses grounding is this idea that you, in the moment, you want to try and ground yourself. Tough to do that. This is an exercise that helps. If you sit there, or you're walking down the street or anything, play this game where you're like, okay, I'm gonna look for five things that I can see right now and kind of name them in your head, whether it's colors, whether it's textures, whatever that is. Four things that you can touch. And, you know, if you're walking outside, you can touch, like, the bark of a tree. You can touch the grass. You can touch, like, your own shirt or whatever. You can touch the hand of the person you're walking with if you're doing that. You can, pet an animal. Like, pets are hugely therapeutic to spend time with. So whatever that is, but things that you can touch. Three things that you can hear. And, you know, you can be outside, you can hear an airplane flying over, or kids playing, or traffic, or birds. If you ever are walking at all, I walk on the escarpment a lot because I live in Hamilton, and if you just stop, and I'll get my kids to try and stop sometimes, and you just listen, and you hear so many different noises that you normally don't. And if you kind of just stand there and tune into that for a minute, you can actually feel the relaxation kind of kick in. There's something that's very calming about that, but quite often we just kind of speed through whatever we're doing. Two things you can smell, and then one thing you can touch. Yeah, I did that. Oh, touch. Interesting. I did that wrong. But anyway, what did I miss? Help me out.
Taste.
It should be. This should be taste. Anyway, because you're not going to walk around licking everything. That would be. So, you could try it. The balance myth. So I do. We use this word balance a lot. You'll hear it all the time. It can be useful, and it's great. And I'm not knocking that word, and I even use it all the time for myself. I think you have to find out what your balance is, though, for your wellness. It's not everybody's balance of, you can't have all these things perfectly balanced. In this one here, it shows, and I can send, anybody that wants these, I can send the slides to you, I think. But in the, I like the way they've done it, because often financial does take over, and occupational is really important. We tend to kind of minimize or not think as much about things like environmental, physical, mental health. Spiritual health quite often gets pushed aside. Social is really amplified. We love to see the value in social and always be social butterflies. So it's looking at what is your balance, what are your values, what are some things you want in your life, and then making time for those things. Are you done? I didn't want to flip it as you're taking a break. So go easy on yourself. With mindfulness, I will say one of the big things is not to be judgmental on yourself, to go easy on yourself. It's not to say, crap, I'm trying to be mindful and I can't do it. Saying, okay, I'm going to draw my mind back to this moment where I'm at. I'm in the woods and I'm walking, or I'm walking down downtown Toronto, but I'm going to try and be, or if you're having a conversation with someone, trying to be mindful of that conversation, trying to be present with whatever you're doing. But go easy, because it's your mind's going to wander. This takes a lot of practice and work to do it, and we never do it perfect. You can mindfully do prayer, which is a really good one. There's a lot of different spiritual practices you can do with mindfulness, too. I understand that nothing can be perfect. Find and use available resources, and it's okay to ask for help. Often we have this like thought that we're not supposed to be dependent on others, and we're not supposed to ask for help, and I think that's one of the things we've lost. I think that we need to be dependent on people. That's important. And I grew up like I hate asking for help. But it to do that, when somebody asks you for help and they're genuine and you can offer that, it feels incredible. So remember that and ask for help and those resources. And I guess in closing, how many, as far as like clients that I see, I mean, I work in so many different settings. How many clients do you think that I work with would be, or what percentage would be people that have mental illness, say, versus people that maybe are already having a pretty good mental wellness going on? Yeah, and I can't give you an exact answer, but that's great. That breakdown is, it's, I would say quite often it's almost 50-50 at any given time. I mean, at any point I probably have 150 people on my caseload. A lot of people come in, not because of, and a lot do come in with mental illness, but a lot come in also because of life transitions, because of life events that have happened, because of divorce, because of grief, because of loss. And they're doing quite well, but to come in and ask for help and to get some skills and tools on how to kind of cope with that. And sometimes all the value is just having a place to talk. It's not that we have some big fancy thing to offer necessarily. It's just having that little sense of community, a place to come and talk and not feel judged. And sometimes we don't have those people. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with you know, getting perspective on those things, because those life events happen, and there's times when it's not going to be as easy to get through them as we want. So thanks very much. I did go over time, and I apologize, but I hope that there's questions. You guys have been quiet, so I'm not sure there's going to be a lot of questions, but that's why I felt okay going a bit over time. But my email address is here if you do have any questions for me. I should have put that on the handout. I did not think to do that. So if you want to write that down, or just, I can give you a card. I have 8 cards, so I don't have that many cards. But if anybody wants a card, we'll get it to you somehow. We'll figure that out if you have questions. And that's me, so thank you. Yeah, I guess if people want to hand them out or pick them up after, whatever works, there's a lot to say. And I'm not. It's not a plug for us, but sometimes people aren't sure how to. Contact or get involved with counseling. And again, I'm realizing most people might not want that. But Shalem has a broader network. So if you do call that number and you're looking for counseling or for someone you know or whoever, a child or anybody, we have a network of counselors through the GTA and even in different parts of Ontario. where if you call, they'll say, okay, where do you live? And we'll try and hook you up with a counselor that lives near you. So even though you're not in Hamilton, there is actually quite a network there. So if you call, and if they can't connect you with a therapist nearby, they can find or refer to other people, or they'll help you out with that. So just, important to know.
I was just wondering if you had any suggestions on perhaps what a person should do if they receive tragic or devastating news. And it just comes at you.
Yeah, I think the first thing is to try and find support, like someone that you can talk to. And if that's, I sometimes say in a perfect world, we wouldn't maybe need counselors or have counselors. I think if you have somebody in your life that you can talk to start with, a friend or that kind of thing, then start with that. And if you want more perspective, or if you're finding it hard to find someone that will listen, then yeah, you can reach out to, if you can reach out to counseling or that kind of thing, then that's good too. But I think it's absorbing that impact right off the bat, right? Because that's going to be pretty shocking. Yeah.
And maybe you have a whole range of emotions coming at you, and you also have thoughts of maybe doing action.
Yeah, it's where I would try and recognize those. I often think now is not forever. I know that sounds trite, but the idea that emotions will come and go, that is a normal response, and that might sound, I know that doesn't sound like a nice, neat answer, but I think it's to try and recognize, okay, this is shocking, or this is really disturbing, and that's actually, that's because I care about this, and then trying to take care of yourself and recognize, okay, what do I need to do to be safe, recognizing what some of those behaviors are that you might want to be doing, and trying to step back and say, what do I need to do instead? That's where having somebody else to talk to or be accountable to can be helpful. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I almost think of it as at that point it's emotional first aid. You need to kind of lock it down, take care of yourself, go through that grieving. I'll use this example. I have a friend that just literally found out this week that his wife is going to be leaving him. And it's really, really been a hard week for supporting him. But he's in that space right now. And all he needs is somebody to listen and sit with him. And every day he texts me. He'll call me at lunch and we'll talk for an hour. I'm watching that happen right now, that kind of shock of absorbing something that's just life-changing. And there's not a simple way, but I think sitting with someone and listening to them and making sure that they're safe and have that is a start. So if you're the person that gets that news, I think reach out and find someone. Okay. Or seek professional advice, too, if you need, Right there, what I just said, actually. But name an emotion that you're thinking. Yeah. It'll come back to me, it's almost always going to come back to the social piece, that attachment that I talked about. I think we're social creatures. We are wired to be around other people. Even if we're socially anxious and it's hard to be in a room with other people, which is common for a lot of people. I think that's probably the number one advice I'd say is there's not any kind of fancy skill or grounding technique that's going to get you through that as much as if you can find somebody to talk to. So I think that's a big piece. Somebody that will listen. And also somebody that, I just have on things. Yeah, I would say 8 times out of 10, when I first meet with someone, the first thing they experience in that room is the idea that, okay, what I'm experiencing isn't actually crazy. And I'm using that word, not everybody likes that word, but it's normal. And I think a lot of times people, that's maybe the value of that very first session or that first conversation that somebody has. Or if you talk to a friend about, hey, this is going on for me, and it's like one of your best friends and you've never told them, and then you tell them. I think most of the time people are shocked to realize that people are way less judgmental and way more forgiving or way more understanding than we think. So I think that's a sign right there of how we're wired for community and we're wired for connection. And even if it's just 2 people, that's still community. That's a way of showing, it takes away that shame. It takes away that kind of embarrassment and that piece where we're worried that something's wrong with us. Is that helpful? Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry, Mary, did you want to ask? Okay.
Sure.
So just to wrap up then, as you're looking at those forms, one of the things we do want to understand from you is what else can we do in this area? What other kind of conversations do we need? What other activities would be useful to you? I mean, it might be something complex. It might be just getting together to talk, or it might be getting together to watch the movie Inside Out. That could be a really fun next step that we could do. Yeah. But whatever it is, either write it on your form or talk to us afterwards, or if you think of it, you know, tonight or tomorrow, call the office and say, hey, you know, this neighborhood could use XYZ, right? So just let us know if you've got those ideas. So again, we want to thank you very much, Stephen. This has been very useful. You coming out, we couldn't have done this without all of you, so thank you for that. Outside, there's more food and drink, and there's also a literature table with all sorts of helps that have been set up as well. Hank, did you want a major issue in the GTA? And so we have a conversation about that here on the 29th. We're getting together with some other area churches and bringing in some very good speakers about that topic. And that will be here as well. So please help us spread that word and join us again for that time. That will